understood. I try so hard, so please don't let me be.
Listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K2A2BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM, and on the web at kboo.fm.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Muertos PDX on Tuesday, November 2nd. From 5:30 p.m. to 8 p.m., streaming online. Muertos PDX is a virtual Dia de Muertos celebration featuring cultural dances, poetry readings, musical performances, and altars to honor loved ones who have passed. Again, that's Muertos PDX, a virtual Dia de Muertos celebration on Tuesday, November 2nd, from 5:30 p.m. to 8 p.m., streaming online. More information can be found on kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Welcome to Let's Talk About Race, an intergenerational discussion about race with independent journalists from the Pacific Northwest. From Grassroots News Northwest, I'm your host and moderator, Lenita Duke.
Hi, I'm Althea Billings. I'm a journalist and radio producer in Portland, Oregon, and I'm Generation Z.
Greetings. I am Professor Johnson, political analyst and educator, and baby boomer from the Lone Star State, Texas.
I am Cecil Charles Prescott. I host a talk show in Portland, Oregon, and I am a baby boomer.
I'm Nia Gray, the faith reporter from Pennsylvania, and I'm Generation X.
I'm Michelle Melton, and I'm an associate producer and technology reporter in Georgia, and I'm a millennial.
Come on,
let's talk about race. Let's talk about you and me. Let's talk about all the good things and the bad things that make me. Let's talk about
race.
Let's talk about
race.
Talk about
race. Welcome to another edition of Let's Talk About Race. On this segment of Let's Talk About Race, Black-on-Black Crime in the Age of Black Lives Matter, hosted by Professor Johnson. And we are joined by our special guest, Mary Lee. Mary is the director of a think tank in Portland, Oregon. Nia Gray, our faith reporter, is on assignment.
Put your hands up! Come here!
When a black man dies at the hands of law enforcement, outrage on the street often follows, but so does another narrative.
93% of blacks in America are killed by other blacks.
Why is there not the outrage when there's black-on-black violence?
Black-on-black crime, a catchphrase some believe conservatives use to distract from police brutality.
And it makes so bad, it's black-on-black crime.
A phrase also recently used by Doherty County Coroner Michael Fowler after a rise in homicides near Albany this past May.
Nobody's saying anything. Like it's just something they're pushing up under the rug.
Not so, says Clifton Crowley. He says black communities are talking about it. The media just isn't paying attention. Crowley is the community chair for the Atlanta NAACP.
There's always been a deep level of concern for violence and poverty and crime within our community.
The licensed social worker points to a long list of local and national organizations focused on reducing violence in black communities, including Street Groomers, 100 Black Men of Atlanta, and former President Barack Obama's My Brother's Keepers initiative.
You have to look beyond the race.
Rodney Bryant is Atlanta's interim police chief. He doesn't dispute violence in black communities is a problem. In Atlanta, 81% of victims to violent crimes were black in 2018. Nearly 90% of people arrested for those crimes were black too. But Bryant argues violence is often a side effect of generational racism, which has created a health, wealth, and education gap.
I think it does do the black community a disservice when you say it's a black on black crime, because now you're saying it's just a black problem.
According to the Bureau of Justice Statistics, the majority of violent crime happens within the same race. A 2018 national survey found offenders were within the same race as the victim 70% of the time for blacks, 62% for whites.
First, these questions really are to challenge what I think are some widely held views. And the purpose of the questions are really to probe deeper. So the first question I would like to put to our panel here, is our perception of black on black crime accurate? We seem to have a perception that there's a higher percentage of crime committed by black people against other black people. Is that an accurate perception? I will start with Cecil. Would you like to respond first?
I think what you said is perception is a key word in that question, because I believe that the way a story or an issue is framed may cause the type of answer or response to it. I think the fact is true that most violent crimes committed against blacks are committed by blacks. It is also true that most violent crimes committed against whites are committed by whites. I think it's wrong to say that people in certain communities are more violent than people in other communities. And I think that popular narrative is rooted in racism and in the way society look at people of color. I think the issues of violence and criminality in communities are things that need to be addressed, but it's deeper than simply saying this is the cause of why we perceive things are bad in a particular community.
Thank you, Cecil. I will turn to Altheo. What are your thoughts?
I'll keep my comments brief, but I really want to address the statistics of it all, plus how those are interpreted by the media, as Cecil kind of touched on, and by news consumers. Statistics, you know, however they're being cited, whether it's related to black on black crime, the black crime rate generally, they can't tell us the whole story of how and why certain phenomena exist. And I say that as somebody that has a degree in social science, so I have the license, you know. When the subject is humans, their interactions, their history, it's impossible to completely isolate your variables. That's something that researchers know, but it isn't always communicated when those findings reach the public. In any given trend that you want to study, there are a lot of co-occurring factors that might be feeding in. For this specific example, the idea of black-on-black crime or the black crime rate generally, without context, as Cecil kind of mentioned, the bare numbers might service a conclusion based on racial stereotypes that Black Americans are especially violent, that they're committing more violent crimes than any other group. But it's important to ask, obviously, like, compared to what? Because compared to the white crime rate, it's much lower. And that's the population statistics. There's more white people committing crimes in the US than Black people. There's more white people than Black people. It's also important to ask how the different pieces that whatever study is referencing, how are they being measured? Is it arrests? Is it convictions? Because Black neighborhoods are more highly policed than white neighborhoods. So of course, those arrest rates are going to be higher. White criminals are also undercharged for the same crime. So if you're looking at convictions, you might see less white people get convicted of the same crime. That doesn't mean that Black people are more guilty
or more rightfully convicted more, but rather that it's a racist justice system that doesn't treat the two groups equally.
Yes, there is some disproportionate offending for certain types of crimes, but there's also a lot of discretionary decision making by actors, criminal justice officials in our system, from arrest all the way through sentencing, by police officers, prosecutors, judges, and others. Discretionary decisions that produce racial results, from racial profiling on the part of police officers to charging and plea bargaining decisions by prosecutors to decisions by judges. I don't think that most of these decisions involve intentional discrimination, but oftentimes they involve implicit bias, unconscious biases that individuals have, that we all have in society, that officials in our criminal justice system have. And unfortunately, when they're making decisions about criminal justice issues based on those unconscious biases, biases they aren't even aware of, can have devastating results and produce the kind of racial disparities that I just talked about. There are also a lot of race-neutral factors that prosecutors in particular take into account that can have racial results in our criminal justice system. And I think the key is to sort of figure out through evidence-based studies, you know, what are the decisions that prosecutors are making that are having these unintended racial consequences? Because once we figure out what those are, then prosecutors can use their power and discretion in ways to hopefully eliminate those disparities, or at least to drastically reduce them.
Let's start with the disproportionate risks of driving while Black. In 2017, researchers at Stanford University studied 4.5 million traffic stops by the 100 largest police departments in North Carolina. They found Blacks were more likely to be searched than whites. That's even though white motorists were more likely than the others to turn up contraband. Let's move to the war on drugs. A 2020 report by the ACLU found, even in the era of marijuana reform, Black people are more than 3.5 times more likely to be arrested for marijuana offenses than whites. Turning to the bail system, a 2011 study of bail in 5 large U.S. counties found that Blacks received $7,000 higher bails than whites for violent crimes, $10,000 higher for crimes related to public order, and $13,000 higher for drug crimes. Let's move to prosecutors and plea bargaining. A 2014 study of Manhattan criminal cases found that Black defendants were 19% more likely than whites to be offered plea deals that included jail or prison time. How about sentencing disparities? Well, a survey of data from the U.S. Sentencing Commission in 2017 found that when Black men and white men commit the same crime, Black men on average receive a sentence almost 20% longer. And finally, Blacks are overrepresented in the parole and probation population. According to a 2018 study by Pew, 1 in 23 Black adults in the U.S. is on parole or probation versus 1 in 81 white adults.
So I would encourage people to get curious when they see statistics like that repeated by others or referenced in the news, like who's being studied, how many people were in the study, what were they using to measure, and what are they correlating that with more broadly. The news media, as again, I'm echoing Cecil here, but they like a flashy headline more than, you know, it likes the majority of social science research, which ethically mostly says that they've gotten inconclusive results about any of this kind of stuff.
There's a lot of misconceptions about Black Lives Matter. That's because the media sucks. I'm not an expert, but I am a Black guy. And we're here at Viceland to clear all the noise. Peep this. When it comes to Black-on-Black crime, the media sensationalizes gang violence, drive-by shootings, drugs. But they don't cover grandmothers having candlelight vigils against murders. That's because that doesn't make any money.
In 2011, a Pittsburgh study linked 86% of stories with Black males to crime, and only 2.7% of stories were about education, leadership, or community. Study after study shows that the media is such a powerful tool that it can shape your perspective.
In some ways, it diminishes Black life and gives an excuse for the type of violence that are enacted in our communities on a day-to-day basis.
If you are just joining us, you're listening to Let's Talk About Race. Our discussion, Black on Black crime in the age of Black Lives Matter.
Thank you, Althea, for your comments. Lenita, would you like to weigh in on this question?
Well, I am not as diplomatic as my two colleagues. I grew up
and I saw black on black crime. I was a victim of black on black crime. And some would say that maybe I perpetrated a black on black crime. I don't know. I think that is a difficult discussion when we talk about personal responsibility, when we talk about how certain criminal behavior is tolerated among African Americans and people play it off because they're saying, I'm trying to get over. But you steal my credit card and you commit an offense against me, and I know you because I'm at your house, you go in my purse, you steal my credit card out of my wallet, you know, I'm stuck with that bill. And we have a relationship that's severed. So again, I'm not as detached from it as my two colleagues when we look at the statistics, because the statistics are other people that black folks know. I know that's not an answer you want to hear. I don't know, is there some validity to black on black crime? And I see our think tank person is here to help analyze why I feel this way.
All right.
Help me deconstruct my feelings, Mary Lee.
I am uniquely unqualified to respond to that. I am not African American. I have my own perceptions and thoughts that have been framed by the environment I grew up in, which was this country. And, you know, you can't separate out what the impact of enslavement from the genesis of this country has wrought in terms of system and culture and everything else. You know, I don't know what the perception is, like whose perception are we talking about? I would say it's probably both over and under articulated, right? That for some, this is an issue of, you know, let them kill themselves. Don't let us get in here because they're going to do the job themselves and you know whatever the stereotypes are. And that for others, it will be, a way in which systemic racism and white supremacy continues to get articulated. Right.
Well, I think it's important to have the perception, not just from Black people on what Black on Black crime is, but to look just generally within our country, that mm-hmm. perception that people have. And you're right, it's shaped by all kinds of things, mm-hmm. where you're from, where you live. That's something that I might bring up in closing. So I think you're sharing just what you're taking in account, all that you've seen and heard personally. How do you view this?
Well, I think about a number of things, and this is true, I think, for all of the questions that that you have there. I always go to a systemic analysis and understanding, because I think much too much of our conversation as it relates to race, racism, and white supremacy in this country goes to an individual place, which is, you know, why can't we just, the infamous Rodney King, why can't we all just get along, right? And if you respect me, I'll respect you. And what's our interpersonal relationships, which I think is critically important. And when you're thinking about the, you know, sort of the state of things, we must think about structure, and none of us interacts in as wonderful of an individual connection as we want to have or can have without being acted upon and acting within the systems that formed and are a part of this country. I think about survival tactics. You know, what has any of us learned, and in particular the African American community, learned about survival? I was just in, I don't know if I shared this with you last time, I was just in Georgia. And every single African-American person that we passed on the street said hello to us, asked us how we were doing, what our day was, you know, nodded to us, acknowledging our humanity. And I was both, and not one white person ever did that to us on the street. Never acknowledged us. We could be right here walking, never acknowledged us. And I thought two things about it. I thought, well, we still understand what it means to see each other as people of color and have that context. And then I also thought that is a legacy of a survival tactic. Perhaps African-American people growing up in the South learned to be able to hopefully blunt any imagined and forthcoming violence that might come to them if they said hello to the white people, if they acknowledged the people walking about them, walking past them. And I think that is part of what I think about black on black crime and this issue of, you know, are African American people any more predisposed to crime than anyone else? And I would say the answer to that is absolutely, categorically no, without exception, without comment. I think about Dr. Joy DeGruy's work, the post-traumatic slave syndrome, that she talked about in the uprearing of African-American children. And, you know, some of the manifestations of that, which now today we would say is not, you know, is not helping us and is not supporting our children to be in that next generation. You know, I brought you into this world, I can take you out. Some of those kinds of things. And really the legacy, that is a legacy from enslavement, where people had to hush those children or they were gonna die. People had to divorce themselves from their emotional ties to these children because they would be sold out from under them. So I think about survival tactics and the legacies and the coping mechanisms that we have learned as cultures and how that plays upon this dynamic of black on black crime, or particularly for African-American men, African-American women. And then I also think about, and maybe this is later, you know, on the eve of Yom Kippur, I think about atonement and I think about forgiveness. And I think what I require and aspire to be forgiven in me, and what I must be able and willing to at least entertain giving forgiveness and you know, so I need to both atone for my transgressions and also desire to be forgiven at this moment of, you know, this holy day for those of the Jewish faith.
If you are just joining us, you're listening to Let's Talk About Race, an intergenerational journalistic roundtable focusing on the issue of race. From Grassroots News, I'm your host and moderator, Lanita Duke.
Hi, I'm Althea Billings. I'm a journalist and radio producer in Portland, Oregon, and I'm Generation Z.
Greetings. I am Professor Johnson, political analyst and educator, and baby boomer from the Lone Star State, Texas.
I am Cecil Charles Prescott. I host a talk show in Portland, Oregon, and I am a baby boomer.
I'm Nia Gray, the faith reporter from Pennsylvania, and I'm Generation X.
I'm Michelle Melton, and I'm an associate producer and technology reporter in Georgia, and I'm a millennial.
Come on, let's talk about race. Baby, let's talk about you and me. Let's talk about all the good things and the bad things that make me. Let's talk about race. Let's talk about race. Talk about race.
Thank you, Mary Lee. So I think in summary, we looked at it in a lot of different ways. Cecil started with the sort of stereotypes that get applied to communities, how that impacts the perception of black on black crime, and the how inaccurate that is to reflect black communities in that way. And then I think Althea brought up a very good point about the statistics and how we, what statistics are we looking at? How do we define crime? Because each layer of that can have a different, you know, lead us to a different conclusion. So we really do have to be careful of these, of how we're looking at these statistics, which they vary greatly. And I think there's some broad things that we've learned about crime and that we can look at, that there is an increase in crime across the country, that the 1990s saw our lowest crime levels all the way up through about 2005. And then we start to see some real increase in crime around 2012 to current times. And what causes that crime and what contributes to it, you know, is probably bigger than our discussion now. I appreciate your systemic explanation and talking about the survival tactics and how the environment impacts crime. I guess in conclusion to this question, what I would say after reading a lot of statistics, the one factor that seemed to lend itself most to understanding crime had to do with poverty. And that if you looked at it from that lens, you get a very different perspective than trying to look at it racially.
2020 rocked our country to the core. It revealed three large problems. The world is fighting a global pandemic. Hundreds of thousands of people died because of it. But the next two issues have been around for years, long before now. Racial injustice among African Americans and black on black crime. Now, some say black on black crime is also killing African Americans, but there's very little outcry. Local 4 obtained crime numbers from the city of Detroit starting last August to present day. Violent crimes like homicides are up 24% compared to 2019, but sex assaults, robberies, carjackings, all down from last year. Dr. Rose Moulton is a licensed clinical psychologist and a racial healing specialist for an organization called New Detroit. We asked her what she thought could help end black on black crime. She sent this statement. It says, implement more accessible community programs to promote emotional and mental wellness and heal trauma. The traumatized mind is disconnected and oftentimes lacks empathy, which makes heinous acts more likely to occur.
If you are just joining us, you're listening to Let's Talk About Race. Our discussion, black on black crime in the age of Black Lives Matter.
We will move on to the next question, which is the fact that the U.S. has the highest incarceration rates of any country in the world. And this most impacts Black people, basically people of color. And for Black people, it's a very critical demographic, the ages of 35 through 39. So is this a representation of criminality among Black people, because it's often one of those statistics that's used? So I'll start with Cecil.
I think what the high incarceration rate is a continuation of the enslavement of Black people. The war known as the Civil War, when it came to a conclusion and the Constitution was amended, the amendment which we hold up as outlawing slavery, outlaws slavery except in terms of imprisonment, incarceration. So the legacy of slavery, of incarceration of Black people continues. And what we see in the high incarceration rate is more a result of our continued inability to create a society where all members are welcome. I'm sure the other panelists can say things very eloquently about the legacy of the U.S. incarceration rate and what it means, how it has destroyed community, how it has prevented families from being created, how it is related to the economy, on and on and on. But for me, I would say if we want to look at the U.S. high incarceration rate, we have to ask the question why and put it in the context of U.S. history.
All right, thank you, Cecil. Althea, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, I would echo what Cecil put to us there. It's part of that same history. It was designed that way. It's not some accident that this is the way that the statistics are, that this is something that the U.S. economy relies on, that is baked into the system from bottom to the top. So no, I'll be brief here. It's not representative of a higher criminality. It's representative of a higher criminalization of Black people rather than some inherent trait.
Okay, thank you, Althea. Mary Lee, your thoughts?
Well, I'm right with my colleagues here in this. I, in fact, would say that the data itself is the evidence, the damning evidence of the systemic nature of racism and white supremacy, rather than any indictment of, an entire community of people. And, it's one of those places where people see what they want to see in the data and use it in the ways that they want to use it. But there is no explanation that I have seen or been able to hear about, and I will fully admit my ignorance, that does anything to explain these disparities in who is in jail versus who's in the larger community and the demographic. other than white supremacy and the intentionality rising from the enslavement of African people. And I think it's important for us to understand just how genius the system is, because then you look at the disenfranchisement of the people who have been incarcerated, in that they can no longer vote. They can no longer have a say in the operations of the very foundations of what one might say is our democracy, right? Is being able to have a voice, and the voice being represented by a vote. That no longer exists, specifically for African American men who have been incarcerated.
I think most Americans believe that after you commit a crime and pay your debt to society, the punishment ends. You have the chance to rebuild your life and get a fresh start, but the reality is much harsher. We punish people with criminal records long after they've paid their debt to society, and we all suffer for it. Even simply being accused of a crime is just the beginning of perpetual punishment. A cycle of legalized discrimination, poverty, and reincarceration, a cycle kept in motion by 47,000 laws and regulations nationwide that restrict critical rights and opportunities. After contact with the criminal justice system, millions of Americans are denied employment and housing, denied college educations, excluded from public benefits, separated from their children, deported despite being legal residents, and deprived of the right to vote. These restrictions trap the poor and people of color in invisible cages that extend far beyond prison walls and criminal courts. Cages that lead to a lifetime of obstacles that undermine even the most earnest efforts at rehabilitation and redemption. Cages that send the message, you will never be a part of society again. This is not some isolated problem. 95% of all incarcerated people will return home at some point. Each year, more than 600,000 people are released from jails and prisons. That's roughly the population of Boston or Seattle. Millions more are completing non-jail sentences like probation, community service, or fines. As reentry specialists at Brooklyn Defender Services, a public defense firm representing 45,000 clients per year, I work on the front lines to help people with criminal histories overcome their past and navigate the obstacles of their present so they can build a sustainable future.
And when you look at, again, sort of, it's not the incarceration, it's the disenfranchisement. And Cecil, you spoke to the destruction of African-American families and communities and women who are continuing to raise children as single parents. And as a parent myself, I don't know how I would ever, you do what you got to do, it's facing you. But the fact that, women who are Black are getting up every morning and getting their kids to school and getting to work is not that it shouldn't be admired, but it actually is, I think, a travesty that we expect that somehow we're going to fetishize that into into the strength of the Black woman, right? The long-suffering Black woman, because it helps us to not have to face the impact of these practices and these systems, because we can fetishize, only put them up to the pedestal to a certain extent, and then when it counts in any other way, we shall disregard and disrespect and disown, the African-American woman and the African-American mother and family, right? The ways in which this carceral state has impacted and continues to impact the Black community cannot be overstated nor disregarded in terms of its lasting impact.
I think my comments in summary to this, and whether or not the higher rates of incarceration are evidence of, criminality of Black people, I think this has very much been used as a justification for taking that position. And so I think it's good to hear all of the comments that show all the ways that logic simply does not work. I thought of a poem, which I'm going to share, and you can cut it out if you want. But Langston Hughes said, "Justice is a blind goddess. To this we Blacks are wise. On her face are two festering sores, which once perhaps were eyes. And I think that's what everyone is talking about here. A couple of comments I had is that I mentioned the 35 to 39-year-old demographic, and I know that Cecil and Mary, you spoke to how this affects the Black community and the Black family. And this is a critical time. These are the fathers. These are the people that should be in the community and are not. I think back to Althea's point about the statistic is the same thing is true for the statistics around incarceration. You know, we cannot really trust these numbers because of the profiling of Black people, the fact that they get longer sentences, that a lot of them are in jail for minor drug charges where other people didn't go to jail or had shorter sentences. We have these factors at work. So it is somewhat an extension of slavery to Jim Crow, and now it's, you know, incarceration. We kind of see impacting the Black community at large. So no, I do not think that we can use that, and we need to stop allowing people to throw that out as a justification or some insight into Black people and crime, making that connection.
I think our criminal justice system is working as intended. It is only broken to the extent that our society is broken. If your intention is to, you know, jail massive numbers of people, if you believe that prison is an effective means of dealing with the myriad social needs of the African-American community, then it's pretty effective. In fact, there's a long history in this country of dealing with problems in the African-American community through criminal justice system, criminalizing social problems in a way that we don't do in other communities. For instance, if you looked at the research, you would find that somewhere around 60 to 70% of the people in prisons and in jails are suffering some sort of mental health problem. Upwards of 50%, you know, go in there dealing with some sort of chemical dependency. Viewed from another lens, these are public health problems. One could look at, you know, the massive number of African-American men who are out of work and the intersection between that and prison. Well, one could look at where prisons are located. And, you know, you would find that a lot of times prisons are located in rural regions, you know, where all other industries effectively shut down. And you might think of that as actually an employment problem and not a criminal justice problem. The enduring view of African-Americans in this country is as a race of people who are prone to criminality. I mean, literally, we have the notion of Black people as, you know, criminals written into our Constitution. We have a fugitive slave clause, which effectively makes all the things that are normal for any other American in that period illegal for Black people. You know, to pursue your own freedom was illegal. Slavery, you know, was enforced by the criminal justice system, the slave laws. It made, you know, very, very ordinary things like learning to read effectively a criminal act. Frederick Douglass is an escaped slave. He's a criminal. You know, he's stolen his body, as he says it in one of his speeches. Harriet Tubman, you know, is running a massive criminal conspiracy, stealing people. I know we all love Martin Luther King today, but in his time by, you know, the highest powers in the American justice system, Martin Luther King was viewed as a criminal, you know, by J. Edgar Hoover. Arguably, perhaps by, you know, the Kennedy administration and the Johnson administration. I say that because they signed off on the bugging, you know, of his home and, you know, wherever he was. The lens of criminal justice is the way this country has traditionally regarded Black people. I don't know that anything is broken at all. The deeper question is, are we okay with something on the order of 4,000 African-American males per 100,000 being in jail? Are we okay with that? Are we okay with, you know, there being a 1 in 3 chance for every, you know, African-American male born in this generation of eventually doing some sort of time in prisons and in jails? Are we all right with that? And that goes to the deeper question of, are we all right with Black people in the position that they are in our society? Or do we have some sort of, you know, long-term commitment to justice?
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Let's Talk About Race, an intergenerational journalistic roundtable focusing on the issue of race. From Grassroots News, I'm your host and moderator, Lenita Duke.
Hi, I'm Althea Billings. I'm a journalist and radio producer in Portland, Oregon, and I'm Generation Z.
Greetings. I am Professor Johnson, political analyst and educator, and baby boomer from the Lone Star State, Texas.
I am Cecil Charles Prescott. I host a talk show in Portland, Oregon, and I am a baby boomer.
I'm Nia Gray, the faith reporter from Pennsylvania, and I'm Generation X.
I'm Michelle Melton, and I'm an associate producer and technology reporter in Georgia, and I'm a millennial.
Come on, let's talk about race.
Let's talk about you and me. Let's talk about all of the things and the bad things that make me. Let's talk about
race.
Let's talk about
race.
Talk about
race.
All right, well, we can move on to question 3. This one is probably one of the most difficult questions. Are Black men the greatest threat to Black women? And that's pretty open-ended, but I'll just put that question out there that way. Cecil, go ahead, Cecil.
Yeah, I would say the simple answer is no, but let me put it in some context. A few weeks ago, I was able to participate virtually because we were unable to gather all in person at a family reunion that we look forward to every couple of years. And members of my mother's family gather. And one of the things we do whenever we gather is we like to tell the story of Jane and Joseph Cobb, who were enslaved in Virginia. And my mother's maternal lines trace ourselves to that couple, a woman and a man who were enslaved, who by the 1870s were listed in the census as property owners. And one of the things my family also talks about, my cousin Elena says, that we come from a line of audacious broads, women who were able to overcome many, many things, and we are still here. We celebrate that. But that doesn't mean that we can put a blind eye to some of the things we've talked about today in terms of how the Black family is under siege, and that we have to have some honest conversation about things such as intimate partner violence. And we have to be honest about abuse and be able to talk about it and to be able to confront it in our communities and to be able also to ask the hard questions about why. And I think Mary Lee spoke about the legacy of slavery and some of the tools for survival that may have been effective 150 years ago, but we have to unlearn some of those things and those habits.
All right, thank you, Cecil, and thank you for sharing that family story. I really appreciated that. I want to, because this is an interesting question, are Black men the greatest threat to Black women? Just give some statistics that gave rise to the person that asked me that question. The first one is that more than 4 in 10 Black women will experience physical violence from an intimate partner, which Cecil talked about, you know, intimate partner violence. This is much higher than any other race. Black women also experience a significantly higher rate of psychological abuse, including humiliation and insults, name calling, and coercive kinds of control. Sexual violence creates at a higher experience rate as well, with more than 20% of Black women being raped during their lifetime. And the last statistic I would get is that they're particularly high risk of being killed at the hands of a man. And that's based on 2015 Violence Policy Center information. These statistics actually come from the Institute for Women's Policy Research. So I just wanted to give that as more as a framework for this discussion.
The most disrespected person in America is the Black woman. The most unprotected person in America is the Black woman. The most neglected person in America is the Black woman. until we stand up like men and place the same penalty over the head of anyone who puts his filthy hands out to put in the direction of our women.
So I'll move on and ask Althea, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, thank you for sharing those statistics. What comes to mind for me is obviously intersectionality, and that overlapping identities and structures of power impact Black women more severely than other groups. And we can see that in those statistics that you mentioned. Not to poke holes in this entirely, but, you know, statistics is kind of what I'm bringing to the table. But I think that it's, you know, important to take note of these things and to take it on as cause to serve Black women better than our society currently does, but to also understand that, you know, Black people, Black men are not uniquely the problem in the sense that people by and large tend to date inside their race. So the intimate partner violence that you've described by and large would come from someone of their same race. That would be what I would throw out there. But I think that the intersectionality angle is important to add in too.
If you are just joining us, you're listening to Let's Talk About Race. Our discussion, Black on Black crime in the age of Black Lives Matter.
Okay, thanks, Althea. Those were great insights. Mary Lee, your thought.
I will firmly state that the biggest risk to Black women is not Black men. I appreciate the perspective Cecil, you and Althea have shared. Dan, I'm curious, are those statistics the rate of violence against Black women, regardless who the perpetrator is, or specifically Black men to Black women? I think
No, those statistics are not tied directly to Black men. It's experience in general.
Yeah, and I think that that data is evidence of the of the complete systemic disregard of the of Black women, and a lot of that violence is not at the hands of Black men. It is the hands of white men. It is at the hands of, you know, any other men that are in the circle. And Althea, I think you're right. People do tend to date within their culture, and there is a particular dynamic, and I relate to it as an Asian American woman, of the sexualization of Black women and girls, especially from a certain mindset that are white males, and the entitlement and the availability that is assumed to be a birthright in their interactions and their relationships, particularly with Black women and Black girls. So I would say even the statistics, while horrifying and probably are underreported significantly because of the law enforcement and lack of action and DAs and everything we've been talking about, I do not put a one-to-one relationship to those incidents with violence and that the violence is 100% at the hands of African-American men.
All right, thank you, Mary. All right, our final question is, are Black youth embracing an anti-intellectual mentality? And based on what's cool and what their peers think are cool.
Black youth are embracing that which is held out to them as possible and attainable to them, even though we know it's not, and we know it is an anti-path to their wholeness and wellness. But when you look at what is held out to African-American young people as what's possible, what they can aspire to, what they actually see in their schools, when you have Black girls and Black boys being suspended from preschool, suspended from kindergarten, you know, treated and put into the tracks for the learning disabled because people, teachers, the system can't respond to the current day trauma that they are experiencing being Black in this society, they're simply looking at what we're offering them as a society. And so I don't think it's a choice. I think they are moving down the pathway that is open to them by popular culture, by the system, and to the extent that their own families are you know, broken and still needing to heal from the trauma and the daily, you know, the trauma informed, the trauma of racism daily. There's a lot of statistics about African-American women, regardless of their economic situation, having challenges with birth outcomes and with having healthy babies, not because they're not taking care of themselves and not because they don't have the economic state to be able to do that, but because of racism and that daily washing in that putrid poison harms the baby in the utero. So you can't just, I think we can't just look at, okay, there's teenagers and they're wilding around the streets, right? And they're not focused. Yes, and I just don't know where the alternatives are offered to them in any real way that touches them, that makes it seem like it's possible for them. So I don't think they're embracing. I think they're merely going down the path that the system and the society has set up for them to go, and it is the exception, not the rule, for someone to be able to challenge that and say, wait a minute, I'm worth more. I am have value. I am going to do these things. And again, I'll come back to these survival techniques. I think a lot of the inner community shaming of, you know, you're acting white, you're, you know, putting on airs, those were survival tactics and survival techniques that people made to be able to protect the, you know, the person who had the desire to go to college, the person who had the desire to have greater learning. And it's another place where we've got to say, that's not serving us any longer. In fact, it's harming us. What do we do instead? And I think that is a question for not for me to answer. That is a question for the community to answer.
All right. Thank you, Mary. Cecil.
Well, as a card-carrying Black nerd who often felt the wrath of my neighbors and friends, I want to acknowledge that there are many influences in communities. And one of the things that I think that people use to survive is that, as Mary suggested, we need to see that there are alternatives. For me, it was important to have the encouragement of my family and of my my community and of my social networks. So with school and church and sports team, and to be quite frank, to see the possibility or the expectation that you are supposed to do these things. But a lot of my friends, a lot of people I grew up with, as Mary suggested, that wasn't seen as a viable possibility. And the fact is that when you are in a society where there are so many economic and social pressures that will keep you down, people will use whatever they can find to survive. We need to continue to affirm our youth, the nurturing community, and say that the struggle is hard, but, you know, as our ancestors taught us, we still struggle. And let's celebrate those things.
All right, thank you, Cecil. Althea.
Yeah, so what comes to mind? I think that Mary Lee and Cecil put it very eloquently, what is really at play here. But I think that the question and the questions that we've been tackling all kind of point to this maybe presumption of moral character. And I think maybe something we should take away from this entire discussion is that, especially when talking about race, but really any, you know, oppressive power structure that exists in our society, when there is a presumption of inherent moral character, we should be questioning it. Because as Mary Lee was saying, you know, we know that, you know, is it that Black youth are turning away from the intellectual pursuits that have been so graciously offered to them? They have a free ride to college and tutoring and support through a school system that isn't designed for them. No, that's, I mean, the American school system is pretty messed up. No kid has that, but it's especially difficult for Black, Indigenous, people of color students. So I think that it's important in this instance to not, you know, shift the blame onto the Black youth themselves, who have to deal with all of the things that we've talked about and are making the most of it and are making new forays into frontiers that previous generations haven't even had access to. That was one of the things that I started thinking of when this question was mentioned, was like the social media generation was the kind of activism that young people have access to that they haven't before, the kind of opportunities that can come outside of college. Not to say that college is a bad thing, but that there's a wider world out there than, you know, I go to college or I don't.
If you are just joining us, you're listening to Let's Talk About Race. Our discussion, Black on Black Crime in the Age of Black Lives Matter.
Okay, thank you, Althea. I just had a couple of thoughts. I thought all of your responses were interesting. I thought the underlying sort of question here is morality. Is interesting because that is how Black people get assigned these stereotypes, is through a lens of morality, so to speak. So I thought that was very insightful. One thing I would say about Black youth, though, is that there's been enough research done to know that something happens. And there's the book, you know, Countering the Conspiracy to Destroy Black Boys, that's somewhat dated now, but I think some of the information in there is very relevant, by Dr. Juwanza Kanjufu. And he noted statistically, by grade four, young Black boys going to school perform pretty well up to grade four, some at genius levels. But at grade four, you start to see this dive down. And the question is why? And that sort of trend sort of happens in academia for young Black boys, that it continues to trend down. So he came up with a number of thoughts. I can't argue them. I've not researched them, but I do lay them out for what it's worth, that it had to do in large part with who's teaching and how do these young boys relate to who's teaching them and peer group. And the other thing that he talked about, which I also think is important with this perception of young Black men, is that, and this is for parenting in general, I don't think it just applies to Black people, but most parents think they can back off in high school when there's a lot of evidence to support that you should be leaning in, not backing out. So those were just some observations. I do think that there is media, there are very influential people that youth look up to, both Black and, you know, other races. I think the kind of those messages do have an impact on how they perceive what's cool and what's not cool. And I have seen students who, because being a nerd, as Cecil talked about, is not cool, actually lose opportunity because they don't want to be identified as that nerd. And I don't think, again, that that's a Black issue. I think that is a youth issue. And the idea that has been laid out about looking at alternatives and seeing that there are other ways to succeed and acknowledging the majority of young people that are actually succeeding, I think those are all real important points for us.
If you are just joining us, you're listening to Let's Talk About Race, an intergenerational journalistic roundtable focusing on the issue of race. From Grassroot News, I'm your host and moderator, Lanita Duke.
Hi, I'm Althea Billings. I'm a journalist and radio producer in Portland, Oregon, and I'm Generation Z.
Greetings. I am Professor Johnson, political analyst and educator, and baby boomer from the Lone Star State, Texas.
I am Cecil Charles Prescott. I host a talk show in Portland, Oregon, and I am a baby boomer.
I'm Nia Gray, the faith reporter from Pennsylvania, and I'm Generation X.
I'm Michelle Melton, and I'm an associate producer and technology reporter in Georgia, and I'm a millennial.
Come on, let's talk about race.
Baby, let's talk about you and me. Let's talk about all of the things and the bad things that make me. Let's talk about
race.
Let's talk about
race.
Talk about
race.
Well, that's our show for today. Thank you so much for listening to Let's Talk About Race. I like to end the show by saying every day and in every way, we hope you agitate for social change. Thank you for listening.
For more information on Let's Talk About Race, visit us on social media. We're on Facebook at Let's Talk Race 1, or check us out on Instagram at LTAR Show or www.letstalkrace.net.
The following program has been produced by Grassroots News Northwest.
Listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM, also heard at translator K220HR Hood River at 91.9 FM, and translator K282BH in Philomath at 104.3 FM. And we're streaming at the top of our lungs.
Tune in Tuesday nights from 8 to 10 p.m. for The Melting Pot, featuring DJs, producers, and electronic artists from around the globe. Win tickets and stay up on events each and every Tuesday from 8 to 10 p.m. on The Melting Pot, right here at 90.7 FM KBOO.
Did you miss the Afro-Caribbean and Reggae Marathon? No worries.